the way men express their trauma or depression can be different from women. So men are often more inclined to act out their distress or the pain in being irritable or aggressive or even violent, or deal with their feelings by medicating, self-medicating with alcohol or other things. And these are difficult things. So if you take a female typical way of expressing depression, it might be being sad or crying or wanting to talk about their feelings with people. This is much easier to deal with. It's at least much less threatening than a guy who might be aggressive, who might reject any offers of help. So it's in terms of the things that I think are most important as a psychologist, I mean, it is a challenge for everybody to try and have more compassion for men and try and deal with these problems more effectively.
Welcome to the show. I'm Joe Horton. On the Guild of Dads show, we unwrap weekly the incredible stories, skills and expertise of the world's most captivating dads and experts, along with topics and stories that will captivate you and impact your life. If you're a regular listener, then I want to thank you for listening in to what I and my guests have to say on a regular basis. Let's say you've only just discovered the podcast, then welcome. Have a scroll back through the back catalogue and discover a ton of other conversations. This podcast is for you, the dads that listen. You're the ones that drive me to succeed with Guild of Dads and help as many dads as I can through the conversations I have. But more than that, your support means I push outside of my own comfort zone daily and lean into becoming the man and dad I want to be, knowing that I can pass on what I have learned. If you want to get involved, you can reach out to me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm doing quite a bit on Twitter right now, which I'm finding a lot of fun. Or also, just drop me an email to joe@guildofdads.com. Tell me a bit about you, where you're from, and what challenges you right now to grow. You can also join our rapidly growing free Facebook group and join the Guild. Over in there, you'll find a positive, encouraging community of other dads on life's journey. The group is now swelling to over 2,000 members now, and the Guild of Dads message is resonating, a message of personal growth and brotherhood and celebrating men and dads, along with the far-reaching impact we can have on society. I'm proud to be on this journey with you guys and leading this movement. So what do you get on this podcast? Each week, we deliver content and conversations that will expand what you think is possible for yourself, enabling you to positively impact yourself in all areas of your life and the lives of those that surround you. We do this by speaking to fascinating individuals, best-selling authors, entrepreneurs and ultra athletes, professors, psychologists, also some ordinary dads like you doing some extraordinary and impactful things. Every episode will give you either actionable resources to take away or a different perspective on a particular topic. These conversations are important and necessary because the world is changing. The role of dads and men is constantly under the spotlight, sometimes under attack, and my dream is to make Guild of Dads the go-to resource for dads like you who want to make some changes in your life and live lives of vision, action, and meaning. So what's today's episode about? The psychology of men. Now, with more emphasis on mental health and specifically men's mental health, this is something increasingly on the radar of society. But how much is actually being done to tailor psychology and therapy to the specific needs of men? How different are we to women in how we cope with distress in our lives? And what are some of the things that are preventing men from getting the help they need? We delve into these questions on today's episode. And that's what today's episode is about. Inside the Mind of a Man. Today I speak to chartered psychologist and associate fellow of the British Psychological Society, honorary lecturer in psychology at the University College London, clinical hypnotherapist and author of 70 peer-reviewed journals, John Barry, PhD. John is a co-author of the book Perspectives in Male Psychology with Louise Liddon, and they are the founders of the Centre for Male Psychology, which was formed to encourage the advancement of the discipline of male psychology, resulting in a better informed psychology of males, both for the benefit of men and boys, and for the greater good of society we all share. He is also chair of the Male Psychology section of the British Psychological Association. Gents, I'm massively privileged to welcome John to the podcast today. And now to my conversation with John. John, welcome to the Guild of Dads podcast.
Thanks very much for inviting me. It's great to be here, Joe. Thank you.
It's a pleasure having you on. And I first grabbed hold of your book, Perspectives in Male Psychology, when I was on Twitter. And interestingly, somebody that I follow on Twitter mentioned the book, and I looked at it and I thought, that looks quite interesting. And the reason it piqued my interest was because I'd not seen a book specifically dealing with male psychology. And also, a lot of the things that I learn from the guests that I have on this podcast, I don't often get kind of citations, if that makes any sense. I don't see meta studies, or I don't see studies that kind of back stuff up. And what I liked about your book was that it delved into a lot of every single facet to do with men and boys and psychology. But what I wanted to ask you first, John, is what was the motivation and the inspiration behind the book and your writing of it? Because I know you co-wrote it with Louise Lydon. So,
yeah, good question. So I suppose the overall motivation is to try and communicate with people. And in one way, we've got two audiences. So we want to communicate to psychologists and also to the general public about important aspects of male psychology. I think at the moment within academia, there's surprisingly little awareness of male psychology. So we have only had a male psychology section of the British Psychological Society since 2018. And there was some resistance to it too. Some people who thought that men are already the privileged people in society. So why should we give them this extra privilege of having a little section of the British Psychological Society too? So we have these misconceptions about men. So people who are not understanding that if men are privileged, well, why are they 3/4 of the suicides and 90% of the prison population and suffering from substance abuse at twice the rate that women do? And, you know, boys struggling with education, having fallen behind girls since the late 1980s. A lot of these problems happening all over the Western world. So a lot of people have, I think, kind of very, very sketchy ideas about what male psychology is about. In a lot of ways, they're wrong-headed. So the motivation for doing the book was to really give people the opportunity to understand some of the science behind understanding the mental life and behavior of men and boys. And you talk about we look at different aspects in the book. So we start off looking at child development, and then we look at education, we look at sports, we look at the workplace, we look at crime, which is always a big issue, look at healthcare, mental health, and then look at masculinity too. And along the way, look at a lot of sex differences research. And as you point out, and I think it's extremely important too, that people aren't just making statements about these things, but they're actually able to back them up with some properly researched scientific evidence. And I will make a distinction between scientific evidence and some of the papers that pass as scientific evidence that are written about men from gender studies and places like that, which are really very lacking in objectivity, sometimes willfully so. Sometimes that's seen as a strength to look at subjectivity rather than objectivity. But I think if psychology wants to be a science, it has to actually respect some of the values of the scientific method. And some people think this is so old-fashioned or even prejudiced. And I just think, well, if you think that, well, you're not dealing with science. And we need to have a science. Science, you know, gets. I'm not a somebody who believes that scientists are kind of godlike or science is going to solve all our problems. But it's definitely helped us a huge amount. And science offers us an evidence base for important things like therapy. So when it comes to things like dealing with people's mental health, which could be life and death situations for lots of people, we have to use realistic scientific evidence to base any of our interventions on, or else, I mean, if we just base it on theory alone or ideology, as happens a lot these days, we're really, really on a dangerous road to letting people down massively. So the part of the motivation too is to communicate to not just to academics and psychologists, but also communicate with the general public. Because I've found, like, I've been involved in male psychology for about 10 years now. And I found that I was kind of surprised how little interest there has been within psychology in looking at scientific aspects of male psychology. But I've been also kind of quite heartened by how much outside psychology, outside academia, outside the social sciences mainly, that people are quite interested in sex differences, and they are quite interested in trying to understand why men commit suicide so much more than women, and how we can help men. All these questions, all these important questions, all the curiosity that should be being addressed within academia are happening outside academia. So we wanted the book to be able to do these two things. One thing that I tried to do, and Louise tried to do, is to make the writing as clear as possible. And this meant kind of keeping, structuring things in a nice, clear way, keeping the sentence nice and clear. All the things that scientific papers and writing should do anyway, but all too often, again, going back into the social sciences, you have a lot of material which is full of jargon, basically, that you have used terminology that seems unnecessary, unwieldy, and incomprehensible. It's almost like you're trying to stop people from understanding what you're writing about. So we wanted this book to be very clear, very lucid, very evidence-based, and very much something that would be for the average intelligent person that they'd be able to appreciate.
Yeah, and it does come across, because it's interesting when you're at school, your English teachers always say, right, cut out the waffle, cut out the fluff. And I hear what you're saying about some of the articles I've read from social sciences. You know, they use as much flowery language as they possibly can to try and make it sound like they're creating and formulating an intelligent argument. And I come away just reading the paragraph and with a headache, because I don't really understand what they're talking about. And what I really liked about the book was that, okay, you could use it as a reference to stroke textbook, but I could read it quite easily through. And okay, there's a few bits where I'm like, I might have to read that a second time because I'm a bit of a dimwit to work out, to just fully grasp it. But 95% of it I could read through, and I could fully grasp what you were saying. And I think that what I've noticed is that a lot of the kind of noise that's coming out of the kind of the like mainstream media and social media around a lot of the issues you discuss is very much kind of unfounded, and no one really sort of backs up what they're saying. And what bears out what you're saying is that I've shared your book with quite a few people recently, and I've screenshotted a couple of pages on very, very specific points. And people have been on to me like immediately, what is that book? I need a copy of that book. And this is not just from the UK. This is from the States as well. So there is a thirst for this knowledge and the basis of it, particularly around the issues of toxic masculinity and patriarchy, because, you know, more than once in the last couple of weeks I've cited stuff from within your book in arguments that I'm having with people around about, because, like, let's take toxic masculinity for an example. It's just one example. Most people, I would imagine, think that this is something that's come about since probably the Me Too movement, but it was mind-blowing when I read in the book that this is something which has been going on for quite some time, which segues into my kind of next question to you, John, which was, what is the difference between men's studies and male psychology. You've touched upon this, I think, already, but what is the difference between those two things, John?
Yeah, they sound very similar, and it's just, I suppose, a different approach to the same subject. So men's studies came about in around the 90s, really, and takes basically a feminist approach to looking at men, uh-huh. and which is very much a kind of social constructionist approach. In other words, it looks at masculinity and men's behavior as being a product of social learning from the environment. So you see things in the media and you see other people's behavior, and that influences your behavior, and that's why men and women behave differently according to this idea, because they have different models that they see in the world around them. Men and women doing different behaviors, including things like boys and girls playing with different toys, because they see that they're rewarded by being praised for using these toys and things like that, which actually have a very, very limited amount of truth to them. And also men's studies kind of takes this, what some people call the deficit view of masculinity, in that so masculinity is not just a social construct in this view, but it's also, there's something a bit defective about it. So you have to be very careful, or masculinity will turn into something that is has negative consequences for men themselves and for the people around them. So men's mental health is often attributed, or men's mental illness is often attributed to things like masculinity preventing them from seeking help, because men don't want to appear weak. Mm-hmm. And ideas like this. And I mean, these are ideas, and it's one way of looking at the world. And I mean, there's elements of truth to these things, which is why they take off. They probably wouldn't be as popular if there wasn't some element of truth there. But they are definitely only a part of the picture, and they're not even the main part of the picture. And certainly they're not a part of the picture that really helps to solve any of the problems that they identify. So in terms of men's mental health issues being attributed to masculinity being a barrier to people seeking help, I mean, that can be true, but actually masculinity can help people to seek help. So for example, if you take some idea like some part of masculinity that men should have a certain amount of control over their lives and things around them, well, if you want to have control over your life, control your health, control your mental health by finding somebody who's going to be able to help you to deal with those things. Like, so the person, the man who is most effective and in control is the man who knows when he needs to seek advice from somebody. And that's good. Everybody, like kings have advisors, you know, we all have advisors for different things. It's no problem seeking advice like that. And men who take that approach, that kind of typically masculine approach, their mental health and their help seeking tends to be improved. But this type of information tends to be completely overlooked. And you don't get I should also say, there's kind of much more research. There's a kind of a big established kind of field of feminist research and men's studies that takes this type of approach. And so there's lots of literature that appears to support this view. But I mean, one of the things about science is you don't just kind of go around trying to prove your point over and over, because that sometimes it's good to be able to replicate your studies and make sure that they're just not a one-off fluke finding. But you can kind of do make the other mistake, which is just taking a flawed idea and kind of continuing to find ways in which to make it look like that flawed idea continues to be true, which is, I mean, and there's several ways in which this research tends to be flawed. Partly it kind of leaves out other explanations for men's behavior. So it leaves out biological explanations or evolutionary explanations, and also doesn't kind of thoroughly investigate whether there is much of an influence or as much of an influence on people of their environment as is often assumed.
It's a reductionist way of looking at it. Very reductionist.
Definitely. Absolutely. So, and they often, people who come from the sort of gender studies or kind of men's studies perspective, like to accuse people who are interested in evidence and science as taking a reductionist approach. Actually, there's nothing more reductionist than saying that the complexity of a man's behavior can be explained just by the fact that they're influenced by the world around them. It's nothing to do with any maybe biological forces or any of the things that might have evolved in us as a species. And for some reason, like, people don't tend to have too much difficulty in understanding that animals and insects and all sorts of other creatures evolve in particular ways and behave in particular ways because of evolutionary forces. But when it comes to people, you get some of the social constructionist school of thought, well, all of them pretty much seem to forget about that and think, well, you know, that doesn't apply to people. We're different. Mm. And we are. In some ways, we're a bit more clever, but, you know, we're not that different. We're kind of, we got this sort of clever aspect to our brain, but a lot of it is just purely kind of, you know, it's been around for eons, what we have, apart from our neocortex.
And my experience of dealing with guys as well bears out what you were just saying, in the sense that I talk about what I term the kind of helpless, hapless man. And I don't, in my experience, guys don't want to be in a helpless, hapless state ad infinitum. They actually want to find the tools, the resources, the knowledge, the wisdom to equip themselves with how to know themselves better, how to grow their awareness, grow their understanding of, like you say, when they need to find help, when they need to look after themselves, how they refine and tweak their kind of self-care routines to kind of keep themselves grounded in terms of hobbies, interests, time out from the family, all these kind of things that, you know, before we came on air, we were talking about this notion of the rites of passage that seems to be missing from the modern world. And I think that hopefully this interest in ancient traditions, which a lot of, I would term, dads and older men are going through right now, hopefully this is going to begin to kind of filter down and they can role model this stuff to, you know, their sons and the other young men in their communities as to how to really kind of connect with being their own therapist, if that makes any sense. Because I think that's what guys want. I think they want to have the power to be their own therapist and not dependent on someone for the rest of their lives, if that makes any sense, John.
Yeah. And I would say, I mean, and it's not just because I'm a psychologist, but I would say that a lot of men are not attracted to the model of therapy that focuses on talking about your feelings as a way of solving your problems. We've done some research on this and we found that men in general, when they have emotional problems, they want to fix the problem. They don't want to talk about the problem. They want to fix it. And I should say that it is very beneficial for anybody to talk about their problem, provided, of course, you're talking about it in a safe space with somebody who you can trust and who's going to have your best interests at heart. But for women, the talking about your feelings type of model of therapy, which is more common, and certainly how therapy tends to be seen in general, that sort of model suits women's way of dealing with, like, and I'm talking, when I say men and women here, I'm talking on average. It's not like, you know, not all men are the same, not all women are the same, but certainly this model of therapy tends to suit women more. So men tend to not really want to go to a therapist to talk, if it just means talking about their feelings rather than fixing the problem. Whereas there are some types of therapy that are more solution focused than others. So for example, coaching is more of a solution focused type of thing than about dwelling on your feelings. What I do, hypnotherapy, is more of solution focused, although feelings do come into it quite a bit, although you don't necessarily have to talk about them an awful lot. Funnily enough, CBT is quite, relatively speaking, compared to something like counseling or psychotherapy, is a more solution-focused type of thing too. And within CBT, there's I mentioned in the book about stoicism. And not stoicism as such, you'll probably find it hard to find a psychologist who advertised themselves as a stoic therapist. But there is something called rational motive behavior therapy, which is very much derived from stoicism. And stoicism is something that men are often accused of as being something that's part of masculinity and something that holds men from talking about their feelings or reaching out for help. Whereas there's been a review, 50 years of research into rational motive behavior therapy, finding that it's actually an extremely successful, and I hate to make other therapists or other kind of types of counselors or psychotherapists feel bad, but RDBT seems to be the best therapy. It's like a very effective therapy.
Mm.
And interestingly enough, it is a kind of, it's almost seems to be geared towards a kind of male way of thinking. Now, I'm not saying that all men should go and only see a therapist who does REBT, and that's not necessarily going to work for everybody. But it does just, I think if, for example, the NHS were to advertise to men that they could get REBT as their treatment of choice. Often you don't get a choice with these things. But if they could do that, they probably would find that a lot more men would go along and find it quite useful. And it's not just focusing on people's thoughts or ways of thinking about things. I mean, it's rational and emotive. It's about dealing with your feelings, but trying to keep your feelings in some sort of context and kind of in proportion, instead of letting them kind of well out of control and in anger or anxiety or depression, those sorts of things. But
yeah, and it's interesting, the point on stoicism, because I think because so many people have said, well, he's unfeeling and stoic, or they're unfeeling a bit and stoic. Stoicism has got kind of bad rep, but in actual fact, the guy, I would say probably 90% of people think that's what stoicism is about. But in my experience of, again, dealing with guys, there's probably a handful of guys on my Facebook group, of which two or three of them I know for a fact have tried to take their own lives in the past, and they are heavy advocates of stoicism. Now, what does that tell you? That someone that has been at rock bottom has found something that they've been applying and using for a period of years that has been an effective therapeutic method for them, for their mental mm-hmm. health. So, mm-hmm. I think that to your point on it being made available to guys, I think a lot of guys are finding it through curiosity, but also I know there's a discussion in my Facebook group about this, funny enough, today, and quite a few of the guys who practice it were educating the guys that think it's just about not thinking, you know. Mm. They were educating them and saying, actually, this is what it is about, sort of thing. Mm. And which is quite nice to see guys helping other guys and say, well, this is what it is about, actually.
Oh, so brilliant.
You might want to give it, you might want to give it a go. But one of the things I say to a lot of gents is to change your relationship with thought and become a lifelong student of the mind. And I think that is a really two good things to say to guys, because we're not taught how to change our relationship with thought, feeling, and emotion and see things for what they are. And the natural thing is to kind of push stuff away rather than actually say, right, what's this? You know, someone said it to me before. It's kind of like the dashboard on your car, and the warning lights are giving you an indication as to what's going on at that particular moment in time. It doesn't mean that your car's going to fall apart. It's giving you that warning lights to tell you what needs your attention at a particular moment in time.
Mm.
And you get to learn how your car works. And that, I like that analogy quite a lot.
Yeah, I like that too. Yeah. Good analogy. Yeah. Stoicism, far from being an absence of thought, I mean, it's based on, and REBT, when I talk about stoicism, I'm really talking about REBT, but it's a system of thought. It's a way of thinking, and it takes a lot of thought to learn how to do it properly. But once you've got it, it's very effective.
Mm-hmm. Well, you just touched upon how therapy is different for men and women, and I know one of the kind of core themes of the book were how men and women are kind of lumped together when we're studying what works for men and works for women. And I know you highlight that as being something that's kind of problematic. Why is that so problematic in terms of it being a kind of disservice to men in meeting their kind of therapeutic needs? Why is it such a problem if we lump everyone in together and homogenize everyone? Everyone's the same, John. Why is that such a problem?
Well, it's a problem because it's a one-size-fits-all type of approach. And of course, like if you take one-size-fits-all, like it's not going to fit. It'll fit some people in the middle, but like loads of people on the edges are not gonna, it might be most people it doesn't really work that well for. And it comes from, a lot of this stuff comes from what apparently is a good idea. The idea is that there are more similarities than differences between men and women. And there are. I mean, it's very true. I mean, like physically, mentally, emotionally, there are more similarities and differences between men and women. That's very true. But it's this thing of if you say that and then just ignore any of the differences as if they don't exist or they're not important, well, that's when the problem starts. And the reality is that there are some differences between men and women by and large, on the average. And these can be really quite crucial differences. So for example, I mean, take an obvious difference. So men and women physiologically are almost exactly identical, but in terms of our reproductive organs, they're really quite a bit different. And that's kind of, say that's a 1% in terms of overall body, that 1% makes all the difference. It makes a huge difference to what we can do with our lives. Like women can reproduce and men can't. I mean, this is a massive difference. There's lots of repercussions. Also, there are kind of more subtle differences mentally, and we tend to kind of not see them because like people's behavior can be subtle. It can be easy to miss differences in behavior. And also the way that we think can be a little bit different too. So, and this can be, once you see these things though, once you recognize them, and for me really, as primarily a researcher, once I've seen the research or done my own research and seen the evidence, well, then you have to be, either you decide that, well, research and the scientific method is useless and pointless and I should ignore everything that comes out of it. Or you have to say, well, maybe this is quite important. So I said, like, we've done some research finding that men and women have a different approach to processing their feelings. This says, this is in some ways kind of quite a subtle distinction, easy to overlook. But it really has important implications, because if men don't want to go to somebody and just talk about the feelings, if they really want to fix the problem, they're not going to want to see a therapist. And if they don't see a therapist, and you were saying before, men might want to be their own therapist. I think that's an interesting idea. I really don't think there's, like, if you think about anything else in life, you tend to have an expert, like a kind of mechanic or a dentist or something like that. I mean, you don't want to be your own dentist, probably. You know, some people have to be their own dentist these days, but that's for different reasons. But I think that it does make sense just to sometimes delegate your dentistry, your dental needs, your car mechanical needs, things like that, to somebody else.
The point I was making is once you've kind of cracked it sometimes, and you've got this, and I think guys find it empowering when they might see a therapist for a period of time, but then they get a hand, like a handful of skills that they can then try and run with themselves and kind of wean themselves off it. Now, obviously, what I'm saying is, if you've got a serious mental health issue, you will need to see a therapist on a regular basis. What I'm getting at is low level mental health issues where guys may have it for a period of time and then they want to get clear and set flight by themselves, if that makes any sense.
I suppose me using the analogy of a dentist shows how much or how often I go to see a dentist. I mean, I go as little as I possibly can. And I think that it's the same with mental health. I mean, I think that there's types of therapies that kind of, once you're in there for years, even if you mightn't have a particular particularly bad mental health issue. And the types of therapies I like are the ones that are most effective and most quick and most safe. The, you know, that's what I think people, and maybe it's a more male typical thing, wants from a therapy. And so you want to go, and it's like when the warning light's flashing, that's when you need to sort of be able to go off. And like, and that for guys in terms of mental health care, it could be if you find yourself that you're going to work and you got a hangover every day for a couple of weeks, you know, that's probably, there's a red light flashing there. Or if you just decided that showering is not such an important thing anymore, and you're just, you know, you've stopped doing things like that, or you're not eating enough, or you're kind of eating too much, things like that. These are all, and I think at that point, if you're not really able to figure it out, and from talking with friends too, I think it's really important, and it sounds like you've got a great network of people there who are able to talk to each other and help each other. But if still that's not really working, or if you prefer just to go to somebody and speak to like in total confidence and private, sometimes that's where therapists are needed. But in many ways, over the last 10 years of me being involved in male psychology, I've found that the type of therapy that's available might not be the thing, like it can certainly help men, but it might not be the thing that men are that attracted to doing. And there's many other ways that men can help their mental health and their well-being, apart from, and when I'm talking about this, I'm not talking about, you know, schizophrenia or things like that, things that really need some specialist type care. I'm talking about more the sort of, like life periodically will kind of jump at us and give us a kicking. And, you know, that just happens. We can't do anything about that. And at that point, you might need some help getting yourself back up together. Mm-hmm. And in that sort of case, you know, you don't have to go to a therapist. And especially for men, there's lots of things that have become unfashionable over the last recent decades. That are quite good for men, like going to a football match and kind of chanting and kind of like a shouting, you know, kind of just kind of letting your emotions out. I mean, that can be quite good for men. Going to playing football, definitely exercise is good, any kind of exercise. Playing team sports is quite a good thing. Lots of different things. I mean, like even going to the pub and having a couple of social pints with your friends. I mean, this tends to be good. And I'm not talking about going to the pub and getting completely smashed or sitting at home and, you know, drinking a load or anything like that. But the traditional thing of going to the pub, having a couple of pints, which makes you feel a bit relaxed, talking to somebody who you know and trust. And it kind of, you feel a bit relaxed and you talk a bit more about what's going on with you, how you're feeling, that kind of thing. Mm. And depending who you're talking to, you may or may not get some good advice, but, you know, you get to talk a little bit about things. You might get something back. I mean, but that tends to be the way that men traditionally outside of the therapy room tend to deal with things. And and I think we need to value those things a bit more. In fact, the people these days are valuing these things again a bit more.
Yeah, and I think one thing that evolutionary biologists have said to me in the past is that this comes from our hunter-gatherer days, where guys would kind of go out hunting and they'd typically be side by side. They would be communicating whilst you're doing an activity. So that could be, like you say, sitting side by side at a bar, going for a run together, going on a bike ride together, going fishing together, going hunting together. There's all these things that are side-by-side activities, and it's just coincidental that all of these activities are things that guys bond doing. And it's a different, like you say, it's a different kind of way of doing it. One thing that really kind of I found really quite interesting as well in your book was, in terms of kind of therapy, how if the therapist is actually saying that masculinity is something that kind of needs to be trained out of the patient, that's quite harmful. That was one of the things that shocked me the most about in the book, actually, was this notion that some therapists are looking to actually train masculinity out of guys rather than kind of call on it as a bit of a strength. And I think there's a couple of statistics in there that something like 80% of men and women don't want their gender blamed on their mental health problems, blamed on the fact that they're a male or a female, but some therapists actually do that. I was just like, what? Why would you do something that's going to be harmful to your patient? So,
well, the jury is out on how harmful it would be. But I mean, there's a big example that's well known is the APA, the American Psychological Association, a couple of years ago came out with some guidelines on working with men and boys. That and some parts of those guidelines, there's 10 guidelines, and one of the guidelines on the actual process of therapy with men and boys is actually very good. But there's a couple of other guidelines in there that are really quite bad. One of them is talks about masculinity being purely a social construct. And this is a misconception that's not just kind of bad science, one-sided view of the world, but from that misconception come other negative things. If you think that men are the way that they are, behave the way they are purely because they've learned it from watching cowboys on the television or whatever it might be, well, then it doesn't really suggest particularly useful ways of dealing with their mental health or serious issues of that kind.
So the other thing that I noticed in terms of the book was something that you mentioned quite a few times, and there's quite a few different levels of these, was biases. And I noticed the first thing that kind of struck me that was kind of quite interesting was in terms of something called gamma bias. How does that operate in terms of what we're finding out about the lives of men and women in 2021?
Yeah. Well, gamma bias is a combination of what's called alpha bias, which has been identified decades ago, where people exaggerate sex differences. So you kind of tend to focus on these differences between men and women that are most obvious and kind of ignore the similarities. And beta bias is the opposite. Beta bias can be summed up by the idea that there are more similarities than differences. And so we get a lot of beta bias when we have this one size fits all approach to men and women. And gamma bias is a combination of both of these things, where you have exaggeration of sex differences in some situations, or identifying sex differences in some situations, but minimizing them in others. So an example would be when men, take a topical example. when there's a murder by a man, like something horrible, like a murder, he murders a woman. This tends to, the fact that he's a man tends to be kind of really focused on, and we have all sorts of soul searching about, or not really soul searching, but just sort of uproar about toxic masculinity and, you know, being something wrong with men and things like that. It gets generalized. The fact that it's a man is highlighted and it gets generalized to other men. If a woman commits a murder, it's not that uncommon for women to murder children, infanticide is something that women tend to do more than men do. It's a horrible thing, but it tends to be, like, we don't tend to hear about that so much, and it tends to be like if a woman does some crime, it tends, her femininity is not really highlighted so much. So we kind of have this sort of the gender isn't an issue when it comes to women doing something bad, but it is an issue when it comes to men doing something bad. So we have so gamma bias works in various different ways like that. So if a woman does something good or remarkable, it tends to be highlighted that she's a woman. So kind of female scientists and things like that these days tend to get really put on a pedestal. But male scientists, like if it's a scientific discovery by a man, the fact that it's by a man doesn't seem to be highlighted. It's just sort of taken for granted. And in lots of different ways, if men do something good, it's like isn't masculinity brilliant? It's just like, you know, some people did something that was good and the gender doesn't come into it. So gamma bias, yeah. And once you kind of catch on to it, it's one of these ideas, you can see it happening an awful lot, and explains a huge amount of different things that happen, especially around issues around gender. So, like, I've had the problem of talking with the British Psychological Society about men's issues and men's mental health. And there's a lot of, like, people somehow just kind of, it's not on their radar. They can't really see the point of it. They think it's unimportant, or they barely recognize that real massive red flags, like the male suicide rate being so much higher than women consistently for years, that doesn't seem to really register with them as something that the psychologists should be getting alarmed about, or feeling that they should take some interest in, or even responsibility for doing something about. And that, you could say, is gamma bias, because women's depression tends to get women tend to suffer from major depression about twice as much as men do, and this tends to be much more on the radar of psychologists. And when I did my undergraduate degree, I was kind of struck by the fact that when we did our module on clinical psychology, that we spent an awful lot of time trying to understand why women suffered from twice the rate of major depression that men did. And we went to lots of different theories, and it was all very interesting. But when it came to male depression, that was dealt with in just a couple of minutes. And basically the conclusion of this extremely brief comment, more or less, on the whole thing, was that men commit suicide more than women, because men are better at DIY, and so are better able at creating more effective ways of getting rid of themselves. And this was greeted with a little kind of ripple of kind of giggling around the room. And I just thought, this is really hard. I mean, this is why we kind of, like, this is about people's life and death. I mean, why are we having some silly little remark about it? Like, why aren't we treating it as something really important that we're trying to understand? And that sort of stayed with me as an undergraduate for years. And I mean, I still hear this type of remark too. I mean, it's incredible that psychologists, who I think a lot of the time tend to think of themselves as more sensitive and empathic and things like that, but you often get this type of attitude that actually it's men's fault if they commit suicide. It's like they didn't seek help. They might have, you know, that they, you know, there's all sorts of reasons that it's men's fault for the problems that they have, which could be described as victim blaming. And I think it's a very useful way of describing that.
Gents, I'm going to jump into the conversation here very quickly. You've probably heard me mention that putting out a regular podcast involves a substantial investment of both time and money to make it happen. Guild of Dads isn't sponsored, and I'm 100% self-funded. So I've recently set up a service called Ko-Fi, which means if you like and appreciate what I'm doing with the Guild of Dads podcast and Facebook group, or even if you want to follow me on social media, then you can buy me a coffee to say thanks and support my work. Just head on over to guildofdads.com and you'll see a small coffee cup at the bottom left-hand side of the screen entitled Donate. You can also follow me on there, so I'll be posting updates and some other cool stuff just to let you know what I'm up to. Any of you guys helping to support the podcast and group by donating will get a shout out on both platforms as my thanks to you for getting behind what I'm doing. If you ever wonder how some of my amazing guests get to where they are in life, the athletes, the entrepreneurs, those making a massive impact on the world, I can tell you that pretty much all of them follow a very deliberate plan or system of some kind. This is exactly what I do too, and I'm revealing how you can implement a plan and system in your own life completely free in my ebook, The Dad Blueprint, over at guildofdads.com/dad. Incidentally, many of the people I interview on this show will be leveraging the power of similar systems to radically level up their lives and transform into the men and dads they always wanted to be. So you'll be in amazing company. And now back to today's conversation. It's interesting you say about that, because the thing is, victim blaming, as you know, I had Graham Gordon on. He was on last week's podcast. And we discussed this issue of victim blaming, and one of the things I put to him was, it's the issue around kind of victim blaming in terms of women. It's almost kind of stopped anyone from actually talking about kind of personal responsibility. His response was very much that the two things are kind of separate, victim blaming and personal responsibility. And so it's interesting though, but that there is very much a kind of victim blaming narrative over anything that happens to women, but it's not, if it's men, that's just different. And I have this conversation with quite a few people recently that a lot of stuff. Okay, we're living in an age of equality, which means that men and women should be treated equally. And you mentioned the universal, I think it's the Universal Declaration of Human Rights from the UN at the end of your book, where people should all be equal. But what seems to happen is when people are challenged on stuff actually not being equal, or that there's a double standard of some description, there's the standard block response is, well, that's different. And we don't seem to be able to elevate the conversation to something a bit more intellectual. And a good example of this is, and this is a kind of very basic example, I was watching, I think it was Cast Away or one of these programs where people are stranded on a desert island. I think it was Bear Grylls Survivor or something like that a few years back. And there was an older lady who was kind of lurking in the kind of jungle at the side of the beach, while this young guy was kind of stripping off and washing himself in the surf. And then a couple of other women walked up and they're sort of, you know, peeking at him from between the sort of trees and stuff and that. And I was watching it with my wife and I said, now, you imagine what the response would be if that was an older guy looking at a young girl washing in the surf naked on TV and then getting a couple of other guys to come up and spy on her washing in the surf. And my wife was like, yeah, I can see your point there. It would be a totally different reaction. I was like, yeah. And I said, I don't care either way. Look, I don't care because it's just sort of TV and it's a reality TV program like that. But the point is there is a different standard when it comes to men's behavior to women's behavior. And this is very much across, you kind of see it on TV. I've seen it as well where, you know, where a guy's been punched or hit or whatever, and it's all very funny sort of thing. And you sort of think, again, if that was done, if the boot was on the other foot, that would be a completely different reaction. And when you start to read about Gamma Bias, you realize how widespread it is everywhere. You know what I mean, John?
Absolutely. And I mean, in some way, you could say, well, there are reasons for these things being treated differently. So like a man punching a woman is going to probably hurt a lot more than a woman punching a man. So there are reasons for that. But if there are these differences, well, then we shouldn't really be talking about everyone being treated equally. Because if you're going to start treating people equally, well, then you have to really recognize that that there are things like male suicide, and there are things like men's substance abuse, you know, being at double the rate that women's is, and that these are things that we have to try and understand a little bit. You know, what is causing that thing? If we're going to be sensitive about one gender, we should be sensitive about the other gender too, or else it is a double standard. It is unfair, and there's just so many there's so much to be gained, I think, by us all as a society just being a bit more compassionate to people. It's difficult though, especially say kind of the way men express their trauma or depression can be different from women. So men are often more inclined to act out their distress or the pain in being irritable or aggressive or even violent, or deal with their feelings by medicating, self-medicating with alcohol or other things. And these are difficult things. So if you take a female typical way of expressing depression, it might be being sad or crying or wanting to talk about their feelings with people, this is much easier to deal with. It's at least much less threatening than a guy who might be aggressive, who might reject any offers of help. So it's in terms of the things that I think are most important as psychologists, I mean, it is a challenge for everybody to try and have more compassion for men and try and deal with these problems more effectively. But it's a challenge, but you know, it's a challenge that we should take. If we want to be a civilized society, I think a compassionate society, we can't just keep ignoring things. And I think especially within professions and like psychology and also in the legal system, in government, I think people have to be a bit more open to having sympathy for people who are having what could be a, you know, a complete mental breakdown, but looks like just like somebody who's sort of drunk and slumped in a pub or something like that. You know, it could be. We have to, I think, recognize these things a little bit more. Recognize that men and women are different. We express our distress differently. We the solutions to that are often going to be a little bit different. We have to do that, because if we don't, we have men who've got untreated trauma, untreated depression, who go around acting out these things, and it can be causing social issues and problems, and they need to be dealt with. I mean, even some of these, the most serious crimes and sex criminals and things like that, if you often look at the roots of these problems, these are, they will have childhood traumas that have not been addressed. And these include some research on child sex abusers, sex offenders, kind of quite serious sex offenders, who have had experiences of child sex abuse in their childhood of themselves. And about half of these men have had the sexual abuse was done by a woman and without any sort of involvement of a man. So, you know, these men are deeply damaged. They kind of act out their damage against women primarily, and it's a really difficult situation. It's a really messy, unnerving situation, and these people may not be at all pleasant, but if you want to do things that are going to stop them from, you know, doing these crimes and doing these things that cause great damage to other people too, you need to get to the roots of the problem. And there are some brave and brilliant psychologists who do this. Naomi Murphy is one of them in the UK, and they really have my total respect. But not enough people are taking any notice of these sorts of things. So we have this kind of great, what Martin Seeger's also called male gender blindness. We just tend to kind of not see these issues. And it is, I have a certain amount of sympathy when it comes to some of these most serious kind of criminal type problems. I mean, I do have sympathy with people just kind of shutting down and saying, just, okay, this is horrible, lock them up and throw away the key. But actually, at the end of the day, if you want to have a civilized society that cares about the people in it, you have to look at whether there's some way that these people can be reformed and rehabilitated. And it's difficult. But I think it's something that we have to do. It's probably the biggest challenge in male psychology.
Yeah. And the thing is that, yeah, when I spoke to you before we did this podcast, I think one of the things that kind of that I've learned is that when you go through difficulties as a young man, you don't have a handbook. You don't have a reference book to say, right, okay, this is what you deal with. This is how you deal with losing a parent. This is how you deal with domestic abuse. This is how you deal with your mum and dad getting divorced. This is how you deal with all these myriad of different issues that young men may have to deal with. And I think it seems like at the moment that we're the society is kind of saying, well, actually, it's really what you should have been doing is dealing with your problems in the way that the handbook dictates. But the problem is you only get that, you only begin to put the pages in your handbook through living your life and your experience of life, and the benefit of hindsight is a wonderful thing. And I think we're almost judging some we're almost judging some men based on like, they've got all this information to hand as to how they can deal with their problems. They wouldn't have had that when they were 14, 15, 16, 18, no. whatever it's going to be. And I think it's kind of an unreasonable expectation in some respects. And I get it that, you know, we can't allow offenders to be roaming around society and reoffending and stuff. I get that. But I think that people don't kind of grasp the kind of roots of why this stuff comes about, which leads me on to my kind of last point, and was how important are the roles of fathers and father figures in the lives of young men, John?
Massively important. And the more I look into it, the more I just realize that we've as a society gone really astray in not valuing the role of the dads. We tend to, like in the media, we see the dad as a kind of bumbling fool type of idiot. But much worse in the family courts, it's so easy for people to get divorced these days. Dads tend to get a really rough ride and end up with, you know, losing out financially. But more hurtfully for them, it tends to be losing contact with their kids. So you know, dads, I think, are not valued enough. But really, they have such a positive role in society too, because if you look at, some people don't like to hear this, but if you look at the research, and there's lots of it, the most stable homes are the ones where the dads are there. And obviously, you've got some dads who are bad dads, and they kind of drink and do all sorts of terrible things. But if you got a decent dad, just sort of ordinary dad in a home, those tend to be producing kids who do better at school. They stay out of gangs. They do better in life in general. And people, you know, as I said, I mean, I know some people don't want to hear this, and this isn't saying anything bad about one parent families or anything like that, who can be brilliant too. But it's just, again, by and large, we take the kind of overall overview of the stats on this one. Dads have a really positive impact. I mean, you know, it's so ironic. I mean, you've got the this such a negative view of men that I think it makes it, it's part of the problem of divorce being kind of just so easily done these days. But when you do that, when you have divorce, you're making it more likely that you will really have rudderless kind of young men coming into society in those families that have boys, and that may really struggle, and especially in their younger years. I mean, like, may really kind of get into quite serious difficulty for themselves and for other people. They might do stupid things that they would tend not to do if they have the kind of guiding hand, which might sometimes be a guiding hand around the back of the head, but the guiding hand of the dad to sort of keep them on the straight and narrow. And a lot of, I mean, talking about differences between men and women, one of the differences tends to be in terms of parenting is that women do a lot more of the emotional sort of caring, taking care of the emotional needs of the child and physical needs in some ways, like with their feeding and things like that. But the dads tend to gravitate more to guiding the child in terms of the you know, what they should, their place in society and how they should behave and things like that. And it seems to be that, like, it's not that people consciously divide themselves up in this way, but it just seems to be one of these sex differences that seems to occur fairly spontaneously.
And interesting Anna Machin said to me, the evolutionary biologist Anna Machin said to me that that dads come to the fore in when kids hit secondary school age, because it's just that mentoring and role modeling and guiding through difficulties. That's when dads really hit their stride in terms of the impact they have on kids. So
true. And I mean, but before that too, like with the things like that seem trivial, like kind of going to the pub seems trivial, going to football match or playing football seems trivial, rough and tumble play with the with your child seems trivial, but actually that's quite a good way of kind of teaching boundaries around, you know, what you like, what's going to be harmful for somebody, or say, like, you know, you're rough and tumble play and dad hurts you or kind of something like that. You find out that sometimes you get hurt and it's unintentional. It's not somebody's fault and you shouldn't really feel bad. You might feel pain. It's kind of quite instructive in lots of of ways. And that's, you know, these are things that kids can miss out on if they don't have a dad there. I mean, there's also, I mean, the thing of like, will any kind of father figure be just as good as a dad? And there isn't that much evidence on this, because the research that tends to be done usually has a kind of fairly kind of muddy definition of what the father is, and it includes stepdads and father figures, or even people who are considered to be emotionally invested in the welfare of the child are considered fathers. And I mean, these, you know, all these different types of people might not be quite as invested in that child's well-being as the biological dad. I think that there's again, maybe a bit controversially, and no disrespect to stepdads or anything like that, but I think quite possibly something about being a biological dad that kind of means that you're more invested there. I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise, but it was. And there is some research that does suggest that the kids who have got the biological dad in the home tend to do better. They tend to kind of grow up with, you know, kind of more emotionally stable, and those sorts of things. Yeah. So the dads, definitely dads are very important. And we don't appreciate them, I think, half enough.
And I think it's my kind of inspiration behind Guild of Dads was very much in terms of dads firing on all cylinders, or certainly being the best dads they can be, has a massive societal impact. It impacts wives and partners, it impacts children, and it also impacts society, the wider society, because families staying together is a good thing. And also bringing children up it has a trickle down effect, because obviously if your kids are growing up well-rounded, well-balanced, then it means that the chances are they're going to go out into society as well-balanced, well-rounded individuals. When they have their own kids, it's going to, you know, that is the kind of knock-on effect of it. And I think that my kind of concern, if you like, is that if we're going to ostracize and demonize men, and if we're going to say, well, actually men are on the fringes of society, you're not important, you're doing more wrong than you're doing right, and in actual fact, we don't need you, in fact, just go away, you're not even entitled to an opinion or a voice or whatever, you've had all your good days and whatever. If we're going to go down that route, then the logical kind of knock-on downstream effect of that is broken relationships, fatherless homes, men's mental health still beginning to suffer, suicide rates still amongst men being high in that 45 to 49 age group, which is kind of, most of those are probably going to be dads in that age group. So I don't, like I said to you before, I don't really get the kind of end game in this, not in terms of the attack on men and masculinity. But if I'm honest, I don't think the people that are involved with it even have thought about an end game in this, because it's become so preoccupied about the ideology aspect of it that the end game and the science seems to have just been kicked to the wayside. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think it reminds me of the issue that Louise Liddon in the book identified as being called slow violence. Slow violence is kind of related to the idea that a kind of poison in the environment, like a toxin in the environment, might not show up as an effect for 20 years or 50 years or something. And it's the same with some types of violence that you might have. So like if you have a drip feeding of negativity to somebody over the years, that might have quite negative effects on them in the long term. And the same again, like the idea of intergenerational effects. I mean, once you set people up to fail from one broken family structure, I mean, they may well replicate it. And I think in many ways, the people who are advocating advocating against valuing dads don't really realize what they're doing. I mean, they might say that men are useless, and the evidence for men being useless is that you've got so many male criminals who are out there being violent, but not realizing actually the solution to that is to have more dads in the home and kind of stabilizing these home environments. And you mentioned toxic masculinity earlier on. I mean, the term actually surprisingly comes out of the men's movement of the 80s, and it was used specifically about more basic cultures that would have rites of passage for the boys to kind of change them from boyhood to manhood. And this would be done by the elder men of these tribal communities. And the idea was that if somehow or other any boys didn't get through this sort of rite of passage, if somehow they didn't get involved in it for whatever reason, their masculinity wouldn't be rounded off in the same sort of way as these other boys. They wouldn't kind of become useful parts of the community who understood that their immediate gratification wasn't the most important thing for them to be doing. Be kind of thinking about protecting other people, to be, you know, providing for the people in their lives. And instead, they would, these boys who missed out on that sort of initiation would kind of go off and become sort of selfish and spontaneous in acting out their behaviors and things like that. And they called that toxic masculinity. And in some ways, I mean, it's way overused these days, and it's kind of taken out of its original context. And so it's lost its meaning in the way that people use it these days. Mm. But in many ways, that what they're describing by that, like this lack of initiation into the community, is a big problem for us today. And I think it's probably there used to be lots of things, like people would, boys would go into like family kind of businesses, or they would go into particular apprenticeships or things like that. That would be a kind of a rite of passage, or kind of give them something that sort of focused them into being a part of the community. And I'm not saying that we have to replicate those sorts of things, but I think we do need to have some way of helping boys. And one of the problems here is who do we trust to help boys who are maybe kind of gone a bit off the rails? Who do we trust to do that? Mm-hmm. I'm concerned that sometimes we get people who say that they want the best for boys, but are not necessarily going to be up to the job of doing that. And I think we really have to, the whole thing of thinking that one size fits all, like the kind of things that will work for girls, the kind of things that work for boys and vice versa. I think we have to get over that. And I think we really have to start appreciating the reality, and stop judging the reality as being a kind of something that people don't like, but start appreciating that, say, that boys really prefer particular types of activities and maybe occupations and interests, and just to say, okay, well, if that's what boys by and large gravitate to, well, let's try and provide that a little bit for them, try and nurture that for them, instead of ignoring, say, like the fact that boys tend to be to do very well at maths compared to girls, and of course generalizations again that some people don't like very much. But instead of ignoring that or only praising it when women do very well in any STEM subjects, I think we need to get back to appreciating the potential that boys have, and really fostering that, and not letting them kind of become kind of sidelined and kind of rudderless and drifting. I mean, that's a horrible thing. We shouldn't allow that to happen. We should be, as a society, there a lot more for those boys and girls in those situations, and also the parents. I mean, I think that whole setup needs to be treated as a lot more important than it has been.
Yeah. And I know people are concerned as well, because, you know, and again, this is something that people are not going to like to hear, but, you know, it's been shown that women tend to marry up and across the social spectrum. And what people are concerned about is that where there's such a high dropout rate of guys dropping out of, you know, university and dropping out of the education system, there's a group of women who are moving up the social scale, but all of a sudden there's a dearth of guys at that level and above of the social hierarchy that they're going to want to pair off with. So that creates another kind of unseen issue, and we could go down a serious rabbit hole on that one. But it's another thing that people don't kind of grasp. You know what I mean?
They don't want to. I mean, it's also that something they don't want to talk about. It's again a type of sex difference in preference for in mate preference that the people judge as being unseemly. You know, it's instead of just saying, "Well, this seems to be a fact," it seems to replicate all through loads of different cultures. Instead of recognizing it that way, people judge it and then don't want to deal with it, and then the problem just gets worse. But I think you're right. A lot of the time, the people who are in positions of power that could create social policy or regulations that might help with these things don't really know what they're doing very much, and in some ways don't really, like, they're not too motivated to do anything. I mean, partly because some of these things that we're talking about might not go down too well with some voters, that they might think that these are kind of retrograde steps. But there you go. I mean, it's just we're too clever by half, I think, a lot of the time, and not really seeing what's around the corner. Unintended consequences was a theme in Perspectives from Male Psychology, and it's very true. I mean, a lot of the road to hell is paved with good intention, and it's never more true than with a lot of things that we've been socially engineering for men and boys in society.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very true. It's very true. It's been a pleasure speaking to you, John, this evening. And to anyone that's listening or watching this podcast when it goes on YouTube, I would thoroughly recommend that you check out John and John. So it's John Barry and Louise Liddon. The book is Perspectives in Male Psychology. I read a lot of books, and it's probably one of the best books that I've read in the last couple of years in terms of just the research that's done. It's easy to read for a lay person, as John said, and it just kind of fills in the blanks if you're beginning to think, well, actually, I'm not too sure that a lot of what I've been told is legit. It definitely fills in the blanks. So it's a great piece of work, John. So I want to congratulate you and Louise on what you've done on it. What is the best way for people to get in touch with you, John, find out a bit more about the work that you're doing, the Center for Male Psychology and your work, really?
Yeah, well, you can get in touch with me through the Center for Male Psychology, or if you email me on john@malepsychology.org.uk, that's an easy way of getting in touch with me too. I'm always happy to answer emails and inquiries and things like that. And I find quite genuinely, like, you don't have to have a PhD in psychology or sociology or anything like that. And in fact, it's sometimes a disadvantage in trying to understand these issues. So if you do want to contact me with any thoughts or ideas that you have, definitely get in touch. I mean, you know, there's always loads of things going on out there that are interesting that I might not be in the loop on. So if you want to get in touch with me and tell me about them, that would be brilliant. And also, there's from time to time, we do research. As I said, like, research has been one of my main things. I mean, I've slightly sidelined recently because of kind of book writing and things like that. But we sometimes do surveys if you want to take part in them. We've got a free newsletter if you want to find out what's going on with us. So you can find out if you just go to the Center for Male Psychology website and get in touch. You can, or just look around the website. There's lots of stuff there.
All right. Brilliant. And one last question I'm going to ask you, and it's not one that I prime any guests for, but it won't come as a surprise. John, what is it in life that gives you meaning?
Okay, so this is a good question, because meaning is such a key thing. And I think you mentioned about Viktor Frankl. I mean, so, like, and he's really hit the nail on the head. I suppose my work for definite gives me meaning. I mean, I suppose a very intrinsically motivated person. I need to feel like I'm doing something. So what I'm doing with the male psychology stuff is has massive meaning for me. Also, my family, you know, so, has a lot of meaning for me too. And I would recommend if anybody is, I suppose there's a time in the life I came to being a dad late in life, but I'm really glad that I did. I mean, I would thoroughly recommend anybody who's sort of thinking that they don't want to be a dad. I'd say just think twice about that. I mean, it's a brilliant thing. There's nothing like it. I've got a little 2-year-old boy, and there's really kind of nothing like being with him. And you know, somebody said to me years ago that children bring sweetness to your life, and I didn't really understand it, but like it's so true. I mean, it's, and I've been quite lucky because he's only come along during lockdown, so I've been kind of locked in, kind of at home, working from home a lot. I'm still working from home now, and so I'm having loads of interaction. I did presume before I was a dad that it would be quite difficult and demanding. Actually, it's way more rewarding than it is demanding. I would say it's just one of these things that I wish more people, or I wish our culture was more encouraging of men to become dads, because there's nothing like it. There isn't anything like it. And you wouldn't want to miss it. And people who do miss it, there's a sociologist called Robin Hadley, who writes about men who are childless in later life. And it's not such a good deal, you know. So I would encourage people, like if you're not a dad, go for it. And fingers crossed you'll have a nice, stable family life, because you don't want to ever lose these kids either. I've done some research too with Families Need Fathers for poor men who have lost their contact with their kids, or a lot of contact with their kids through the family courts. And this is a really punishing, soul-destroying thing. So, like, with that caveat of like, you never want to lose them, I would thoroughly recommend people consider having them.
I love it. I love it. John, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you this evening. We've delved into a ton of topics. So I wish you all the best going forward. And thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Joe. It's been a pleasure anytime. And good luck with what you're doing. I think is brilliant. So keep it up. And thanks again for asking me on today.
No worries. Thanks a lot, John. Take care.
You too. Cheers.
A big thanks to John for joining me. You can link up with him over on Twitter. Look him up at the Center for Male Psychology, which is over at centerformalepsychology.com, where you can see what he's all about and the fantastic work that they're doing over there. Now, I grabbed a copy of John's book a little while back and chewed through it very quickly, as it's very readable for a lay person. What piqued my interest the most was the fact that the book presents a very different view to that which we're used to hearing in pop culture and mainstream media, dispelling many of the myths around men in general. We delved into some of these on today's conversation, but in a society where certain elements are very much gunning for men and boys on a daily basis, it was massively refreshing for me personally to speak with an individual who stands together with a growing group of professionals really beginning to fight back around many of the information myths that are being pushed against men and boys right now. Like we said towards the end of our conversation, what is the end game in this? Is it that we're currently in a social experiment for which nobody knows what the end result will be? Will it be that our sons and daughters will see the outcomes further down the line? These are really important questions for us to consider when it comes to the current discussion and narrative around men and boys. Now, if you want to link up with me, you can do so on Twitter or Facebook using the handle @GuildofDads. Let me know what resonated with you about this episode. Perhaps the messaging directed at men and boys has gone too far for you. Maybe you worry about the narrative and the one-sided messaging that goes on. Did I mention that you can now buy me a coffee on my website, guildofdads.com? It's really easy and helps keep the lights on here at Guild of Dads Towers. Just head on over to guildofdads.com, click on the coffee cup button and go for it. Those of you who do donate, get a shout out on here and in the Facebook group if you're a member. In order to have a positive impact on the world, we improve ourselves and inspire others. Share this podcast with others so that they may benefit from anything you have found useful or interesting. If you make a point of sharing Guild of Dads with friends and relatives, it means that it can grow, expand, and help as many men as it can just going forward like you. The other thing that you can do is leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, which really helps other dads to find the podcast. Right now, the Guild of Dads Facebook group is growing fast, very fast, in fact. If you want to get on board, head over there and join up today, where you can get around a lively group of other guys talking everything about being a dad and improving themselves as men and dads. Hopefully, you find something insightful in every episode, so share with dad you know. In the meantime, live a life of vision, action, and meaning. Apply what you hear, and we'll see you next time.